We did get your message last night, and we are acting on it. We've done some research this morning. We've already talked to one of Ben's friends, and it seems that the boys who play furry football often share identities and passwords.
I know it was him, I said. The knowledge was an itch that wouldn't go away, and her words, however kind, were failing to act as a salve.
I realise that the idea is terribly attractive, Miss Jenner. Believe me, it's a tantalising thought that we might be able to communicate with Ben. But you must realise that there's no way we can confirm that it's him, and I don't want you to raise your hopes too much.
Did any of his friends admit that it was them?
Nobody has so far, but you must remember that children aren't always truthful. Not because they want to lie, but sometimes they're scared. And it could have been another friend. We've only been able to talk to one boy so far this morning.
I'm his mother. I know it was him. He had a new player in his team, a player that he was talking about wanting on Sunday morning. It was a giraffe.
She ran her index finger up and down a deep line between her eyebrows.
Could another child have got the new player?
It was Ben. He's alive, DCI Fraser. I know he is.
God knows, Miss Jenner, I hope he is too. And I am taking this seriously. It is very useful information, of course it is, and I will not forget it. I am listening to you. But it is important that we view it in the context of what else is happening in the investigation at this moment.
She shifted towards me, her eyes penetrating and sincere.
Believe me, I shall do everything in my power to return Ben to you safe and sound. I understand that waiting for news must be desperately difficult for you, but we are working around the clock here to make progress. And the bottom line is, every moment we spend with you is time taken away from the focus of the investigation.
Her words finally got through to me. But what worse sin could I commit than to divert their energies from this investigation? I began to cry again, and I wondered if that would ever stop happening, that public leaking of emotions. I didn't apologize for it anymore. It was just something that happened to me that other people had to get used to, like your stomach rumbling or breaking into a sweat.
I didn't want to waste your time,
I said. She took my hand in hers, and the warmth of her hand surprised and disarmed me.
You're absolutely not wasting my time. You're informing me, and the more information I have, the better. But I can't just go out there and search every house in Bristol where somebody logs on to furry football. It's impossible. At this stage in the investigation, my quickest route to finding Ben is via whoever took him, using all the information I have at my disposal. And this information is logged in my noggin now. I won't forget it, and nor will my team. We'll have it in mind whenever we interview somebody or whenever we make a decision. You understand that?
I nodded.
Your information is valuable.
Okay.
I'll arrange for somebody to drive you home.
Ben's alive,
I said.
I'll be in touch,
she said,
as soon as there's any news. Wait at home.
Heading down to the foyer, vision blurred still, unsteady down flights of identical stairs, feet slapping on their linoleum treads, feeling things slipping away. In the foyer downstairs, I was surprised to see Ben's teacher. A picture of composure in contrast to my wrecked self, Miss May was perched on a sofa in the waiting area, handbag on her knee, hands draped on top of it. She wore very little makeup. Her hair was pulled back neatly and fastened at the nape of her neck. When she saw me, she got up.
They asked me in for interview, she said. About Lucas.
She whispered the name. Eyes wide with disbelief, red-rimmed and bloodshot. I wondered whether that name would be whispered more now, only spoken of in hushed terms, because Lucas Grantham might be a child abductor, a predator, a monster.
What did they ask you?
I'm not allowed to say.
That didn't stop me.
Anything? Did you think of anything? Do you think they're right?
I told them absolutely everything I could think of,
she said.
Do you think he did it?
There was a heightened quality about her. Flushed cheeks and quick movements.
Honestly, I don't know. Maybe. Definitely maybe. I'm trying to think back over everything, in case there were signs. I'm really trying. There was nothing obvious or I'd have said before, but there are some things, little things that...
She opened her mouth again as if to say more, and I felt as if she was going to confide something in me, give me a drop of hope. But our conversation was brought to a halt, because the officer who had retrieved the books from me and John a few days earlier appeared suddenly beside us, car keys jangling in his hand.
Eli Bennett, he said. Okay if I drive you both home together. Apparently you live reasonably close to one another.
It was 9 a.m. and the rush hour was abating. Bennett drove us through the city centre, where the roads were hemmed in by smog-drenched modern buildings, throwing endless reflections of tinted glass back at each other. Office to let signs, boarded shop fronts, student accommodation with jauntily coloured plastic windows, and concrete 60s edifices rotting in the pollution. At street level, office workers were arriving for work, trainers on, coffees and briefcases in hand. I broke the silence in the car. There was something I wanted to say to Miss May.
I'm not sure I've ever thanked you properly for all the effort you made with Ben last year, when we were going through our divorce. I really appreciated it. He did too.
He did have a hard time.
She gave me a wan smile.
Well, you helped him a lot.
It was the least I could do,
she said.
They're such little souls. It's a privilege to be a part of their lives. You must feel so very empty without him.
Bennett cursed at a cyclist who was climbing laboriously up the steep slope of Park Street, wobbling into our path with the effort. I fixed my gaze on the tall Victorian Gothic tower at the top, dominating the skyline, Bristol University's most recognisable building. Beside it was Bristol Museum. I thought of Ben's favourite things there. The ichthyosaur skeleton, a case of glowing blue crystals, a stuffed dodo, and a painting by Odilon Redon.
I don't feel empty, I said to Miss May, because I know he's alive. I know he is. But I do feel very afraid.
My words petered away, the last few dregs of sand falling through an hourglass. She looked out of the window, and I worried I'd spoken too freely, exposed the depths of my misery without enough filtering. It's a line I've crossed many times since. If you talk too openly about terrible things, people shrink from you. Her handbag was on the seat between us. It sagged open, and in the silence, my gaze fell on its contents. A set of keys, phone, plastic-wrapped tissues, A4 papers folded in half, charger cable, hairbrush, a leather document wallet, and yet more stuff underneath. The assorted paraphernalia of a life. When Miss May turned back towards me, her expression was unreadable.
I'm so sorry, I said. It's just hard.
No, it's fine. I just can't imagine how awful it must be for you. I mean, I can't sleep at night, and that's just me. I think all the time about how difficult he must be finding it to settle without his nanny.
My hand went to my mouth, knuckles pressing on it, trying not to let myself break down again.
Sorry.
This time the word caught in my throat.
please don't be sorry. I totally understand. I'm the one who should be sorry. I didn't mean to upset you any more than you are already.
I took deep breaths that shuddered and ached, got control of myself eventually.
I'm fine, I said, and you're right. I don't think he's ever slept without his nanny before.
She nodded. The light was murky in the back of the car, and her face looked drab and shadowed. Behind her, through the window, prettier streets flashed past now. Houses painted in pastels or mellow in bath stone, attractive even under the flat grey sky. When I think of it now, that moment has a filmic quality, as if time was stilling.
Poor little soul,
she said. The parting and closing of her lips was mesmerizing. An unsettled feeling prickled at the back of my neck. I glanced at D.I. Bennett. He was oblivious to us, concentrating on a turn he was waiting to make, indicator light thudding, his lips slightly parted in concentration.
Are you all right?
Said Miss May.
Really?
She was peering at me. I started to say something, but lost my train of thought. I was trying to deal with the unease I suddenly felt. The sense that something didn't fit.
Miss Jenner?
Her neck looked long and white as she leaned towards me. I turned away from her and towards the window as I tried to concentrate, to pinpoint the source of my edginess. I replayed our conversation in my head, and the unease crystallized into a thought. A moment of perfect certainty. A bright white light that was terrifying for its clarity. My throat went dry.
Is this it?
Said D.I. Bennett. The road was narrow, with cars parked on either side, and we were blocking it. We pulled up outside a four-story Georgian townhouse, fronted by a broad pavement constructed from huge slabs of stone, uneven and worn. The house was part of a long, elegant crescent, which had leafy gardens opposite, enclosed by wrought iron railings. The crescent had far-ranging views across the city and the floating harbour, towards the countryside beyond. Trees and rooftops in the foreground, then more buildings falling away below, the glint of the river, and beyond, distant fields and hills under rolling grey skies. And on that morning, sheets of rain approaching relentlessly, one after another. And I knew then that I had only seconds to act. What I did next, I did on sheer impulse.
Jim. I woke up with my head in a vice, mouth dried out and the urge to vomit, which turned out to be unproductive. I was still in my clothes. Woodley picked me up at 7:15. It was still dark, freezing cold. Woodley had the heaters in the car turned up full, pumping warm air around. I'd just finished fumbling with the seatbelt when he tapped the dashboard with the flat of his hand. You ready, boss? He said. Are you going to put the address in the sat-nav then? I asked. Or will we guess how to get there? He got going. Tucked into the footwell by my feet was a newspaper. I picked it up. The first page headline had moved on from Ben Finch. Superstorm Sandy. Hurricane heads towards New York. 60 million Americans could be affected by high winds, rain and flooding, a superstorm expected to make landfall on the East Coast on Tuesday. I flicked through. Found him on 4. Hit a wall? Police investigating missing Benedict Finch, still pursuing multiple lines of inquiry. I didn't bother to read on. He wasn't good, but at least it wasn't nothing, and they didn't have news of the arrest yet. The blog was bad. Negative publicity was bad, but no publicity was worse. I dropped the paper back into the footwell. It was dark and shiny wet on the road, taillights ahead of us blurring when the wipers swiped intermittently. We left the motorway and were immediately on country roads, which twisted and turned so the oncoming headlights loomed out of nowhere, blindingly, and forced us into the side where our wheels hit deep puddles, sending spray clattering up onto the windows. As dawn broke, the landscape around us began to emerge. Low rounded hills and washes of black ink against a blue-black sky. The sky finally lightened as we made a steep descent into Pusey Vale, showing us that it lay flat and wide below us, a dense white mist lingering at its lowest points so that it resembled an inland lake. It was a freezing mist, and once we were down into the valley, it settled firmly around us so that our headlights were muted and reflected back at us in the whiteness. As we got closer to the cottage, the lanes got narrower, and the mist thicker still until we could only see yards ahead, and the car decelerated until we were crawling. Tall, dense hedges reared up oppressively on either side of us, and Woodley had to drive carefully to avoid the potholed verges. We pulled into a lay-by that was about half a mile from the cottage, according to the sat-nav. We were too early to call on Nicky Forbes. It was only 8:30, and we needed to kill a bit of time. Fraser didn't want her complaining that we were harassing her. I got out of the car and lit a cigarette. I went to stand by Woodley's window. He wound it down a touch. "Did you notice if we passed any houses on the way here?" I asked. "Closest one I saw was about half a mile down the road." "Same here." I felt uneasy. The mist was impenetrable, limitless, and disorientating, and inhabited by a deep cold so that my toes were already numb. The cigarette was doing me no favours, so I stubbed it out when it was half-smoked, carried the butt back into the car with me, and saw Woodley's nose wrinkle when I stuffed it into the ashtray. I felt a curl of nausea in my gut, and I rubbed my eyes hard, and Woodley said, "You all right, boss?" "Yeah, why'd you ask?" He went silent, small shake of his head. He looked nervous. He had his phone in his hand, and he started to polish the screen with his sleeve. I felt like I should give him some sort of advice, but it was difficult to think what to say. "It's not a normal life, this, having this job. You're outside society." I wasn't saying it well. I wanted him to understand what I meant, but he wasn't looking at me, and the motion of his hand polishing the phone continued round and round. "Some cases make you grow up fast." As soon as I said it, I thought it sounded patronizing, but he didn't seem to care. "Have you ever worked on something that's remained unsolved?" he asked me. "This case will be solved," I said. "We're close now, I swear it." "I know," he said. "I just wondered." I thought about it. There were always things that you never got to the bottom of in cases. A dog walker who was never identified. A random white car supposed to have been at a scene which nobody ever confessed to driving past. That was normal, though sometimes it drove police officers mad, seeking answers that they never got. They couldn't let it go. I'd seen that happen once or twice, but I'd never worked on anything where we hadn't got our perpetrator, and I didn't want this to be the one. Not with a young boy's life in the balance. Not with the worst of crimes a possibility. "Not yet," I said. "Do you think she'll cough?" Woodley asked. "A woman like Nicola Forbes won't hand us a confession on a plate. We've got our work cut out." We moved on cautiously through the mist and found the cottage half a mile further along the lane. Above us you could sense the weight of huge trees looming, although only their lower branches are visible as suggestions of their might. We parked beside a red Volkswagen Golf in front of a wooden fence that was warped and green-grey with lichen. I knew from the car's registration that it belonged to Nicky Forbes. We approached the cottage through a white wooden gate and up a short garden path paved in uneven stone. Wet leaves were banked against the threshold, and the path was lined with rose bushes, pruned back to their bare bones. The cottage was pretty, cream-painted with a silvery thatched roof and small windows set into thick walls. It wasn't a large place. I guess it had maybe 3 bedrooms, 1 bathroom. Some of the curtains were drawn upstairs, but through a window beside the door, I could see into a compact sitting room. The furnishings were plain and tidy. There were books lining the walls and an open fireplace. Yesterday's papers were open on the coffee table. As far as I could see, there were no outbuildings at all, but with the mist reducing visibility severely, it was hard to tell. I pulled hard on the doorbell, and we heard it clanging inside.
Rachel. Miss May peered out of the car window at a house with a glossy black door.
"This is it. Perfect. Thank you," she said.
"Thank you for helping us with our inquiries,"
Bennett said.
"It was the least I could do."
She got out, taking a moment to straighten her coat. Her bag was still on the seat beside me. I could see her keys, but before I could move, she leaned down and peered into the back of the car.
If there's anything I can do for you, truly, please let me know. Thank you, I said.
A car had pulled up behind ours, and the driver sounded the horn sharply, wanting us to move on.
They'd better mind their manners, said D.I. Bennett.
I could see his narrowed eyes in the rearview mirror, watching the car behind. I had one chance. Miss May reached for her bag, but before she could get to it, I picked it up.
Here you go,
I said. I held it out to her, but as I did so, I let it tilt and then fall, so that its contents tipped out onto my lap and down into the footwells.
Oh, I'm so sorry,
I said. I leaned down and scooped up her belongings from the dark recesses, blocking her view. I stuffed most of them back into her bag. Half-eaten granola bar, purse, phone, charger, tissues, packet of painkillers, document wallet. The keys I kept for myself. I slid them between the seat and my thigh. Behind us, the car horn sounded again.
Come on, ladies,
said D.I. Bennett. I handed the bag back to her, careful to hold it by the top so that it didn't gape.
It's all there,
I said.
Are you sure?
She asked. The car behind flashed its headlights.
All there,
I said.
Bye. Take care,
she said, and shut the car door. D.I. Bennett accelerated away. In the side mirror, I could see her standing on the side of the road. Her keys were digging into the underside of my thigh, and I moved them into my coat pocket, careful not to let them make a sound. It was a 10-minute drive from Clifton Village to my house. We drove along the edge of the downs, flat, muddy and green, dog walkers and joggers ploughing around its perimeters, trees dotted across the parkland like abandoned livestock, water tower looming. I listened closely to the police radio. I was terrified that Miss May would contact the police as soon as she tried to get into her house and realized the keys weren't in her bag. She'd ask for D.I. Bennett to drive straight back there. I wished I'd taken her phone, too. We skirted around the edge of suburbia, 1930s semis mostly, John and Katrina's house just round the corner, a few minutes to my place. The radio was spitting out little bits of noise. Nothing about the key so far, but panic was making me swallow, my mouth awash with warm saliva, which had a bitter, tannic edge from the police station tea.
D.I. Bennett, I said.
What's up, love?
It's what Miss May said, about Ben's nanny.
What did she say?
His eyes met mine in the rearview mirror.
Well, it's just that she wouldn't know about his nanny.
I'm not sure I'm following you.
He's embarrassed about his nanny, that's the thing. It's an old cot blanket, a ragged thing. He's had it since he was a baby. He uses it to get to sleep. He would never have told her about it.
Silence as he negotiated a roundabout.
Couldn't he have told her about it?
He asked. Victorian terraces now, narrow streets climbing up and down hillsides. I leaned forward between the front seats.
He would never tell her. That's what I'm telling you.
The radio sputtered again, and I raised my voice to drown it out. D.I. Bennett parked on my street, a few doors away from my house, and turned to face me.
Right,
he said, stringing the word out, skepticism the subtext.
Are you sure about that?
I've never been so sure of anything in my life.
I'll tell you what I'll do then.
His careful tone of voice made me think he wasn't taking me seriously, that he was just humouring me.
I'll pass that information on to the boss. Would you like me to do that?
Could we call it in now? I think it's important.
I'm heading straight back now, and I'll let them know, and that's a promise.
D.I. Bennett, I don't think you understand.
I've promised, haven't I? Can't do more than that. They'll ring you if they think there's something in it. You better get out, love. Don't worry about that lot. Come on, I mean it.
A few journalists were in front of the house, watching us. He wound down the window.
Clear off out of her way,
he shouted.
Go on, get away!
Another blast from the radio, and I knew I had to go, or the news about the keys would surely come through. I climbed out of the car, my head down and my hood up, and ran for it. Inside the house, I stood there with the keys in my hand, and I tried to think what to do. Skittle, still in his cast, wove clumsily between my legs, his tail wagging, wanting affection. I called Kenneth Steelhouse, and yet again I asked to be put through to Fraser, but I was told she was busy and would call me back. They assured me that they understood how urgent my request to speak to Fraser was, and that they'd pass my message on, and somebody would get back to me. Nikki answered her phone, listened in silence as I blurted the whole story out. Lucas Grantham's arrest, Miss May in the car on the way back home, everything.
"Tell the police again," she said when I'd finished.
"Call them back. Make them listen."
In the background, I heard the distinctive sound of the doorbell at the cottage.
"Where are you, Nikki? I thought you were at home."
"I've got to get to the door. Sorry, I'll call you back."
"Don't go."
"Okay, hold on. Let me just see who it is. I'll get rid of them."
I heard the sound of her footsteps, the click of a door opening, a male voice. Then Nikki was back on the line saying,
"I'm so sorry, I really have to go."
And it went dead.
Jim. Nikki Forbes was on the phone when she opened the door. Her expression told me that we were the last people she expected to see. She was dressed already, but her face was void of makeup, and she wore her paleness like a mask. She looked like she was sucking a lemon as she led us into the small kitchen and gestured to us to join her at a small table that was set against the wall. A smoking cigarette lay in a circular ceramic ashtray that had fag ends crushed into its base. The table and chairs were a shiny orange pine, dented in places. The floor was tiled with small white squares grouted in black, and the cabinets were white with the wood trim around the edge. The room was a throwback to the 1980s. Nothing had been updated for years. It wasn't what I expected from Nikki Forbes, because I'd seen her blog, the pictures of her cooking on her Arga in a perfectly equipped and decorated modern kitchen. The kettle had just boiled, but she didn't offer us a drink. "Are you a smoker, D.I. Clemo?" she asked, and she held out the cigarette packet that was on the table. "No, thank you," I said. Woodley shook his head too when she aimed the packet at him. She dropped it back onto the table where it landed with a slap, and retrieved her half-smoked cigarette from the ashtray. "I gave this up years ago," she said, "when I got pregnant with my first daughter." She sucked smoke in deeply, her eyes on mine, her gaze direct and challenging. "I'm wondering why you're here," she said, exhaling the smoke slowly so that it billowed between us, "when my sister is in Bristol frantically trying to get hold of somebody who'll listen to her when she tells them that she has evidence that Ben's alive. I'm also wondering why you're here when you have a suspect in custody. Ben's teaching assistant, is that right? Shouldn't you be trying to gather some evidence against him, maybe?" She looked from one of us to the other, and when neither of us replied, she slammed the side of her hand on the table, a show of temper that made Woodley jump, but not me. "What is the matter with you people?" Her face was angry red, and her manner was that of a teacher demanding an answer. It was all about control with her, I thought. This was an attempt at a display of control from somebody who had lost it. But I wasn't worried about cracking her. I knew I was a good interviewer, very good. When I was in my first couple of years of training, I spent hours with my dad honing my interrogation skills, role-playing until he'd caught me out with every dirty trick in the book, and then taught me how to recognize them and work with them. "You'll hear excuses," Dad said to me one night. I was visiting the family home, and it was after dinner. Mum was washing up, and Dad and I were talking in his study. The window was wide open, and outside the late summer heat had just folded itself away, so we were sitting in the early gloom of a cool, velvety night. "Blokes will say that you aren't a magician," Dad went on, "that you can only do what you do. That's bullshit. It's whinging. It's for people who aren't good enough. If you're worth anything, you can get the truth out of anyone, but you've got to be good." Two cut-glass tumblers sat squat on the table between us, two whiskies. My dad shut the window and switched on his desk lamp. The shade glowed dark emerald and dropped a rectangle of light onto the surface of his desk. He sat back down again. "Again," he said. In the kitchen of Nicky Forbes' cottage, I took a chair and pulled it close to her, so we were practically knee to knee.
Rachel. So, here's the thing. What do you do when it's just you? When you know something and nobody will listen? When you want to do something, but you don't know how dangerous it is or how much you will be risking? When you have only minutes to decide? I was used to making decisions about my life that were based on my complicated relationships with others. Do I need to name them? Most of us have them. They're generic. They could include your resentment of parents, or a sibling, or your desire to please your family, or a husband, or your fear of losing him. They could include your ambition, or your perception of what parenthood should be. I could go on. But at 9 a.m. on Monday the 29th of October, all those things fell away. There was just me, and I had a choice. I could believe what was written about me, that I was worse than useless, incapable of a sensible or moral decision, and I could obey DCI Fraser's request and wait quietly at home for news. Or I could act. I could take the certainty I felt and do something. On my own. Again. Because I was sure. Don't think that self-doubt didn't course through my veins and threaten to weaken me. Don't think that I didn't consider the possible risks of acting alone. The risk for Ben and for myself. I fought both those things. I fought them because I knew I had to rely purely and simply on my instinct as a mother.
"Be strong," Ruth had said. "You're a mother. You must be strong."
And that was enough for me. I understood in that moment, on that morning, that being a mother had given Ruth a single silken strand, strong as a spider's web, which had tethered her to her life. It was the string that had led her time and time again out of the enveloping and dangerous depths of the labyrinth that was her depression. It had prevented her from slipping fatally and completely away into the dark, seductive folds of melancholia, and stopped her sinking into the drowsy escape of a terminal pill overdose, or seeking a tumbling, chaotic fall from a height and its inevitable, brutal, shattering end below. It hadn't stopped my own mother. She'd been overwhelmed by the love she felt, by the fear it made her feel. Her emotions had drowned her sanity, such was their power. But I was different. I knew my son was alive, and I knew where he was. So, you might wonder what I did. I opened a drawer in my kitchen and looked over the contents. I chose a vegetable knife. Short and sharp, easy to conceal. I put it into one of the deep pockets of my coat, laid down, beside my phone. I put the keys I'd taken into the other. Then, I left my home through the studio at the back, unseen by anybody, and I began to run.
Jim. Nicky Forbes was disturbed by my proximity. She shifted, tucking her legs under the table away from me. Her body language was pure avoidance, but I was okay with that. I'd learnt to be patient. Woodley sat on the other side of her, keeping more distance, his posture relaxed. Good lad, I thought. He'd been listening. We'd planned to use the Reed technique in the interview. It's not very nice, but it's very effective. It's a well-known technique that makes use of a good cop, bad cop routine, so Woodley had a role to play as well. As well as being my foil, he would be my eyes. He would watch for her body language that would betray her. Nicky Forbes folded her arms over her chest. "Are you finished?" I said. She flinched slightly, a small jerk of her head away from her hand which held her cigarette just in front of her mouth, the smoke curling between us. "See, the thing is," I said, "here's how I see it." I kept my voice gentle but persistent. I wanted her to listen to every word I said. "I think what you went through as a child was a terrible thing. I think that when you lost your brother, when you lost Charlie, you never really recovered, did you? Then you had to bring up Rachel, and she was ungrateful, wasn't she? She never knew how much you had to suffer, or thought about how hard it was for you to keep the secret about your parents and about Charlie. She took a deep pull on her cigarette, her eyes on mine. I went on. So when Rachel had Ben, that was difficult for you, wasn't it? You had four daughters, but that's not the same as having a son, is it? She didn't know how lucky she was, because for you, having a son would be like having Charlie back. So I think you didn't have a choice. I think you thought that Rachel was bad for Ben. You reckoned that she couldn't look after him as well as you. She's divorced, after all, bearing a grudge against her husband and his new wife. That's not a happy home. And Ben's been unhappy in the past year. We know that from his teacher. That must have pained you. In fact, I think it was really hard for you to bear. She gave a small, brusque shake of her head. Then she ground the cigarette out in the ashtray, crossed her arms. Four children is a lot, and all girls, too. Were you hoping for a son, Nicky? Is that why you wanted to try for another baby this year? Your husband told me. Has it been all about replacing Charlie? Her eyes began to glisten with tears, but she didn't move a muscle. I didn't draw breath. You mustn't, because if you do it, it gives them the chance to deny things, and that can make them stronger, just the act of saying it. You have to carry them on your narrative until they finish it for you and hand you the ending you're waiting for. I inched my chair just a little closer to hers. Her head bowed. I leant forward, put my elbows on my knees, and looked up at her. You see, I think it was just too much for you in the end, that Rachel had Ben. You knew you could do a better job than her, and you wanted a son of your own. She shuddered. I know what it's like to want to protect, I said. I can understand why you did it. You left your own family. You didn't want them. You wanted him. And you wanted him for the right reasons. It was a mother's instinct, a proper mother's instinct, wasn't it? You knew you could do a better job than your sister. She covered her face with her hands, let out a moan. I wondered if she was going to break quicker than I thought. I could almost smell it.
Rachel. It took me 25 minutes to get back there. I stood in front of Miss May's house, panting and soaked to the skin. The only dry parts of me were the depths of my pockets, where my fingers nestled around the handle of the knife and the hard edges of the keys. The street was empty, and in front of me the slate sky was reflected in polished window panes that were speckled with rain, and the black wrought iron railings separating the house from the pavement looked sharp and forbidding. I approached the house and looked at the names and buzzers beside the front door. None of them read May. I peered over the wrought iron railings that enclosed a dank courtyard at least 12 feet below ground level. It was worth a try. I took the steps down one at a time, slowly, stone tread slick and treacherous. The doorbell wasn't named. I rang it. No answer. I got out her keys and tried the Chubb key in the deadlock. It turned smoothly. In went the Yale key too. Soft click. And I had to give the door a bit of a shove, but it opened, and I saw a dark hallway ahead, daring me to step into it. "Hello?" I called. It wasn't too late to pretend I was just returning the keys, but there was no answer. "Ben?" I called. Nothing. I felt almost disabled by fear, but I forced myself to walk down the dark, narrow corridor. Filtered daylight beckoned me from the other end. I glanced through an open door on my left. It was a bathroom, and it was immaculate. Fixtures gleaming, expensive-looking toiletries in a neat row. The door opposite showed me her bedroom. On the bed was a suitcase, lid open, neatly packed. At the end of the corridor, I found her living room. It was large and rectangular, the full width of the back of the house. There was a compact, neat kitchen area and small dining table at one end of it, a sitting area at the other. The room had stripped wooden floorboards and three wide, pretty windows with wooden shutters folded back, sills low and wide enough to sit on. The outside space it overlooked was little more than a light well, but there were pretty furnishings, and the whole effect was of artful good taste. It was a flat I might have been envious of, under different circumstances. Standing in the centre of the room, I saw myself reflected in a mirror over the mantelpiece. I looked white as a ghost. My hair, blackened by rain, hung in damp hanks around my face, and patches under my eyes were as dark as storm clouds. My skin looked slack and undernourished, and the injury on my forehead was healed but prominent. My eyes were darting with fear, and something else as well. There was desperation in them, and a glint of wildness. I looked completely mad. Doubt coursed through me. This is what a total breakdown must be, I thought. You find yourself standing somewhere you shouldn't be, doing something so out of character that you wonder if you've become somebody else entirely. You've lost the plot, taken a wrong turning, jumped onto a train whose destination is total lunacy. I must leave, I thought. I must go home. I would have done that too, but as I turned to leave, I noticed the door. It was in a corner, partially obscured by the kitchen units. An apron, oven gloves, and tea towels hung from it on a neat row of hooks. Layers of paint had dulled the panel detail on it. It was probably a larder, I told myself, or a broom cupboard, and I should just go. But I found that I couldn't. I felt compelled to walk towards it, and as I did so, I heard someone whimper, and I realized it was me. I stopped in front of the door. My left palm was moulded around the handle of the knife, and I rested the tip of my index finger on the bottom of the blade and pressed down a little, feeling it bite into me, making me flinch. There was nothing to be heard apart from the slow drip of rain from somewhere outside. Even the hands on the kitchen clock moved soundlessly. With a feeling of horror uncurling within, I reached my hand out towards the door and clasped the handle. It turned, but something stopped the door opening. It was jamming at the top. I reached up to a bolt that was drawn at the top of the door. Tremulous, unreliable fingers fumbled, but managed to draw it back. I opened the door, stepped behind it, and there was a soft click as I pulled it shut. I could see nothing. All around me it was pitch black, and I had to use the light from my phone to see that I was at the top of a short staircase, and that there was another door also bolted at the bottom of it. I started to make my way down. The darkness was so dense that I needed my hands to steady me on the narrow walls. Two more steps, and I reached the door at the bottom of the staircase. Once again, trembling fingers pulled the bolt, pushed the door open. My fingers felt for a light switch, and found one. The hesitant bulb blinked and then glowed the dull orange of a polluted sunset before it brightened, revealing the room to me, making me gasp. It took me long moments to absorb what I could see. It was a boy's bedroom. Freshly painted walls, bright yellow, thick blue carpet on the floor. A rugby poster and rugby club scarf, both pinned up. Some reading books, a teddy bear on the bed, wearing a scarf. There was some clothing, a pair of small slippers, a dressing gown in softest white toweling. A wooden-framed bed made up with a cartoon-patterned duvet set on it, a pile of DVDs and a television set on a table in the corner, a chest of drawers with pirate stickers decorating it. No Ben. No natural light. I picked up one of the garments. It was a pajama top for a boy, bright red cotton, a dinosaur printed on the front of it, grubby marks around the collar. Age 8, read the label. I held the top to my face. I inhaled the smell of the fabric. and I knew that Ben had worn it. He had been here. My fingers dug into the soft cotton, and I held on to it as if it were a living, breathing part of my son.
Ben,
I whispered into it.
Ben.
My eyes roved again, looking for more signs of him. And what struck me was that there was nothing in that room, nothing at all, not one thing that was right. If Miss May had made this space for my son, and I was convinced that she had, then she'd got it wrong. Ben didn't like Rugby. He'd never have chosen bright yellow walls or a babyish duvet set, or the type of reading books she'd left out for him, and he wouldn't have liked the pirate stickers on the chest of drawers because he preferred dinosaurs. The bear on the bed was a version of Baggy Bear, but it wasn't him. His ear wasn't sucked. This was a room made for an imagined boy, not for my boy, who would never have felt at home here. And then I saw something else. Scattered all over the bed, beneath a fresh scar on the wall where it looked as though it had made impact, were the components of a smashed laptop. Shards of plastic, electrical bits, and keyboard keys, all separated from one another by significant force. Ben would have liked the laptop. He might have played on it. But he might not have been allowed to go online to play his favourite game. The laptop might have been snatched from him and hurled against a wall in anger. And would that anger have then been directed towards him? I fumbled for my phone. The reception was poor, but it was enough. I called 999. And when I'd finished the call, I stood in the middle of that space, with the painful wrongness of it in every corner of my vision, and the shattered computer components a glowering hint of violence, and I began to moan. And it was a dreadful, primitive sound. And the moans turned into a shout for him, a final, desperate plea, an ululation, like the one I'd made in the woods 1 week before. And I fell to my knees. Hope shattered. Transcript. Emergency call. 29:10:12 at 10:17:06. Operator. Ambulance emergency. Hello, caller. What's the emergency? Caller. I found a boy. Okay, where have you found him? I'm in the woods, Lee Woods, just over the suspension bridge. My dog found him. He's lying on the ground. He's covered in a bin bag. Can he talk to you? He's all curled up. He won't wake up. So he's not conscious then? No, he's not conscious. Is he breathing? I don't know. Okay, do you think you can check for me, if he's breathing? He's curled in on himself. I can't see his face properly. Hang on. How old is the boy? I don't know, maybe 7 or 8? He's quite little. He's so white. He's really white. Oh, God, you've got to send somebody, quick. They're already on their way. It doesn't delay them for me to ask you some questions, so don't worry about that. I need you to have a look and see if he's breathing or not, okay?
He's freezing cold to touch, and he's in a state. Oh, God. Oh, my God. He's not even wearing anything except underwear. Jesus, oh, my God.
All right, you're doing really well, and help is on its way. They won't be long now. Can you tell me whereabouts in the woods you are?
I'm off the main path, by a swing. Help, quickly, help!
The whole time we're talking, they're on their way to you, so don't worry about that. Have you managed to check if he's breathing?
Oh, God, it's him, isn't it? I think it's Ben Finch. It's the missing...
The phone goes dead. Operator calls back, but gets voicemail.
Jim. Nicky Forbes's expression was complicated, proud and defiant, but with a touch of something else, too, that I read as surrender. We were getting close to a breakthrough, I knew we were, but then Woodley's phone rang. It was the world's most stupid, immature ringtone. Of all things, it was a Star Wars theme tune, and just like that, it destroyed the moment. Woodley was mortified. I was furious. Nikki Forbes laughed. You are so fucking incompetent, she said. I felt an ache in my temples as Woodley, instead of turning the phone off, took it out of his pocket and looked at it. She wasn't as close to giving up as I'd thought. She was combative, but that was okay. That I knew I could work with, but Woodley wouldn't shut up. He said, It's Fraser, I'd better take it. Nikki Forbes was watching, not missing a trick. I desperately didn't want her to get the upper hand. The read technique depends on the interviewer keeping control of the process, moving from one stage of the interview to the next. It can be a long process, and we'd only just got started. As Woodley slipped out of the room, I tried to regain control. Let's discuss what you were doing on Sunday, the 21st of October. No, she said. Let's discuss why you are here wasting my time and harassing me when you should be looking for Ben. Where's Ben, D.I. Clemo? Where is he? You actually have somebody in custody, and you're here targeting me. You know nothing about me. Nothing. Do they charge police for wasting their own time? Do they? Because that's what you're doing. My family is everything to me. It's everything. At this moment in time, I can't cope with it very well. But that's nobody's business apart from mine and my husband's. It's not a criminal offence to take some time out. So stop treating me as if I'm some kind of monster. My life has been difficult, and I cope with it the best I can. Do I want a son? Yes. Do I want Charlie back? Yes. Do I find my family too much to cope with sometimes? Yes. Did I take Ben? No, I did not. Am I a monster? No, I am not. Do I love my husband, my daughters, my sister, and my nephew? Yes, I do. Is that it? Is that all your questions answered? It was the way she said it, hands slamming down on the table as she made each point, as if her very existence depended on my understanding those things. Faced with those words and her certainty, I simply felt everything start to slip through my fingers, the interview and the case I wanted to build against her. I pulled my chair back, loosened my collar. Outside the kitchen door, the mist was still thick, and it was impossible to see more than a few meters into the garden. Get a grip, I told myself. Get back into it. Hold your nerve. You can do this. But then Woodley reappeared, and when I saw the look on his face, I knew that I'd be lucky if I came out of this with even a shred of dignity. He held up his phone as if it had something written on it that I should read. We have to go, he said. Something about the way he said it made me understand that it wasn't negotiable. Thank you for your time, I managed to say to her, and the chair scraped on the floor as I stood. There was a static noise in my head. It had a size and a shape, and it was swelling as if it was being pumped in. Get out, she said quietly, as if she'd never seen a creature more disgusting than me. Outside by the car, Woodley said, They found a boy, in the woods, and they found the site where he was held. Woodley, I said, but then I didn't know what else to say. I puked onto the thorny stems of one of Nikki Forbes's neatly pruned rose bushes. Bile and bits of unidentifiable spew spattered around its base, leaving a pattern that can't be mistaken for anything other than the hot disgorging of somebody's guts. I wiped my mouth, straightened up, and felt pain ripple across my abdomen. I'll drive, I said, and Woodley handed me the keys.
Rachel. They prized me up off the carpet, which had been so freshly laid that bits of blue fluff stuck to the knees of my trousers and my forehead and my arms. They escorted me up from the flat with a blanket wrapped around me, and they put me in an ambulance that was parked on the street. The press were there too. Of course they were. Only a few of them arrived quickly enough to photograph me being wheeled into the ambulance, but one person with a camera is all it takes.
Rachel! Rachel!
They shouted as the shutters fired.
Are you all right? Can you tell us what happened?
Inside the ambulance, a paramedic did checks and asked me questions. They said they were treating me for shock. I refused to lie down. I sat up, blanket wrapped around me. It was all I had the strength to do. Shaking my racked body like convulsions. Then it was the turn of the police. They told me they were in pursuit of Joanna May. They said nothing about Ben. Their faces were grim, and I found I had no voice to ask questions. I had imaginings. I felt as if chunks of me were separating themselves from my body, falling off. I imagined blood creeping in at the edges of my vision, a red tide. It was because I knew I was too late. He had been there, and now he was gone. And what were the odds that she'd keep him alive? I felt myself let go. I let go of hope. And then, cutting through the murmured voices, I heard the ambulance radio. The dispatcher was calling for somebody to respond to a call in Lee Woods. Precise location unknown. A young boy found. Status unknown. They had to sedate me. Blackness fell as swiftly as the blade of a guillotine. Transcript. Emergency call. 29:10:12 at 10:38:28. Operator. Hello, ambulance and emergency, how... Caller.
Oh my God, thank God. I've been disconnected. Can you hear me? I've been trying to call you back. I was talking to somebody, but my phone went dead, and I couldn't get a signal again. I found that boy. I found him, but he's in a really bad way.
Where are you, caller?
Please, hurry up.
Can you tell me where you are?
I'm in Lee Woods by a rope swing, off the path. Are they looking for us? Should I go to the path?
Hold on just a second. Okay. Consult somebody briefly. All right, help is already on its way. They're nearly with you, but it's best if you stay with the boy, and I really need you to tell me if he's breathing if you can.
He is breathing, but it's really bad breathing. I can't feel a pulse in his arm. He's freezing cold. I've put my coat on him.
Right. Is he conscious at all?
No, he's not.
All right, you're doing well. Can you see if he's got any injuries on him? Is there any blood?
I can't see any blood. He's got bruises up his arm. He's making weird noises.
Right. Can you carefully move him onto his back as quickly as you can and have a look in his mouth if you can? Check there's nothing obstructing it. Keep him lying as flat as you can.
I'm doing it. God, he's cold. He's soaking wet. Oh, God, where are they?
They're nearly with you. Can you tell me how's his breathing now?
Bad.
But he's still breathing, right?
I got him on his back.
Look in his mouth. Is there anything in there? Food or vomit?
No. His lips are blue.
Is he still breathing?
Yes, he is. I'm going to lie with him. I'm going to give him my body heat.
Okay. They're a few minutes away from you now. They're making their way along the main path in the woods. Can you give me some more detail about where you are? Can you tell me where they need to turn off the main path?
There's a pile of logs opposite the entrance. Cut up logs in a pile, about halfway round the path.
I'll let them know.
I'm lying with him. He's breathing really bad.
Can you shout? I want you to stay with him and tell me straight away if he stops breathing, but can you shout to help them find you? They're very close, but they can't see you.
Help! Over here! Help!
Well done. They can hear you. Keep shouting.
Help us! Help! Over here! Where are they?
Don't worry, they can hear you, and they can see you now.
I can see them. Here! Quick! He's here!
Are they with you now?
Yes, they're here.
Okay, I'll leave you with them, okay?
Yes, thanks, all right.
Thank you, bye.
Jim. We made it to the woods in 1 hour. I used blue lights. On the way in the car we got more details. About Ben Finch's condition. About Joanna May. And the room in the basement of her flat. We interviewed her, I said to Woodley. We should have fucking seen it. He didn't respond. The paramedics were still working with Ben Finch in the woods. They couldn't get the ambulance to the site, so they had to stabilize him and move him in stages. We parked, and I ran. I wanted to be with Ben. I wanted to see his clear blue eyes for myself, see if there was life in them. I wanted to tell him that he'd be okay, that his mother was waiting for him. I wanted to do that for him, at least. Rain was falling in a downpour, crashing through the canopy above. The trees lining the path were bowed and streaked from it. They arched over me, a skeletal tunnel of bare branches, urging me onwards, making me feel as if it was impossible to make progress. My breathing was ragged and fast, my heart thumping, my clumsy feet tripping over sticks, stones, each other, never moving fast enough. With every step I was soaked some more, but with every step, I cared less. I rounded a bend in the path, and ahead I saw the ambulance and a stretcher being loaded on board. I pushed myself, tried to